Going to open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. Going to open up work session on House Bill 2477.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2477 has a revenue statement and no fiscal impact and a subsequent referral to tax credits. It extends the sunset for the earned income tax credit to 2020.
Thank you. Representative David Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and happy Friday. I would like to move House Bill 2477 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Tax and Credits by prior reference.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2477 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Tax Credits by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Gallegos. Aye.
Representative Yeltsin.
Absent.
Oh, her name be excused.
She will be back.
Is she excused? Okay, go ahead.
Representative
Gallegos. Aye.
Representative Dyer.
Representative Gelser, how do you vote on House Bill 2477?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Dyer. Absent.
Representative
Winston.
Aye.
Representative
Winston.
Absent.
Well, she doesn't protect you.
Vice Chair Bomber.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Aye. Having received the majority of votes, the measure passed. I will reopen the work session on House Bill 2477. Representative Whitsitt, how do you vote on House Bill 2477?
Aye.
Is there anything else I need to do with that, Debbie? Close up the work session? Okay, I close up the work session on House Bill 2477. I will open up the work session on House Bill 2417.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2417 has a revenue statement and a fiscal impact and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It raises the county clerk property filing recording fees from $15 to $20 for purposes of assisting veterans. It requires a minimum 25% of monies deposited in emergency housing account to assist veterans at risk of becoming or currently experiencing homelessness. It allocates 25% home ownership assistance account fund minimum to serve low-income veterans and families of veterans.
Colleagues, remember we had a hearing on this on March 6th. Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 2417 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and it be referenced to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Gomberg moves House Bill 2417 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by a prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, will you call the roll,
please?
There was please.
Discussion here, I think.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's just me.
It is Friday.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I want to make sure you're calling on me. Thank you, Madam Chair, or others that may have noticed me. I cannot vote for this measure unless it is entirely, exclusively for the aid of veterans. And I have been assured that it is, and I want to make sure that's on record. This is only for the assistance of our veterans, and I'll be an aye.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I'm going to support the bill as well. I just wanted to add that I live in a wonderful part of the state where we not only have a lot of people moving out our way, but also people buying vacation homes out our way. And I would say a disproportionately high number of real estate transactions. For that reason, I think that we would probably pay a disproportionate amount of this new tax. And I have some concerns about that being spent in other parts of the state, but I think that my constituents would feel the money would be well invested in supporting our veterans, and I'm going to support the bill as well.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll, please.
Representative Gallegos.
Yes.
Representative Yeltsin.
Yes.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Kenny Guyer.
Absent.
Representative Richmond.
Aye.
Representative Whitson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Blumberg.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Chair Tomei.
Aye. Having received the required number of votes, this bill passes. And with that, I will close the work session, House Bill 2417, and open up an informational hearing on housing. Representative Gallegos.
This is episode two, and we'll have our housing representatives come up and present.
I think there's a PowerPoint that...
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Margaret Van Vliet. I'm the Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. And I'm here to provide, as Representative Gallegos mentioned, sort of part two of our overview of the Oregon Housing and Community Services transition plan. So I'm going to walk you through a slide deck fairly quickly here, and then Janet Bird will also offer some comments. So this may be a reminder for folks. This is just a quick overview of the range of programs that my agency currently provides and has provided for some time. And they cover these areas that we've roughly talked about, sort of span a continuum, if you will, of housing-related supports for low-income Oregonians. Safety net, energy and weatherization, multifamily rental housing, and on. So I'm going to just quickly remind you what the core of these services are, and it should tie to what we talked about a couple of days ago. In the category of things that we refer to as safety net programs, this is the suite of programs that includes food supports, emergency food and the food bank, emergency housing assistance and rental assistance kinds of programs, and homelessness prevention and rapid rehousing services. These are primarily, though not exclusively, delivered through that network of community action agencies that operate at the local level. The category of programs that we refer to as energy and weatherization address high energy costs and health and safety kinds of issues in homes that would benefit from better weatherization. So we do two basic things with this category of programs. We help low-income Oregonians pay their utility bills in the winter, and we also go out through partners and weatherize and upgrade homes so that they're more weathertight and safer and healthier places to live. In the multifamily rental development, this is probably the most complex and the largest dollar volume of work that my agency does. We act a little bit like a bank in this arena. We provide housing funding programs for affordable housing development, including new construction, preservation, acquisition, and rehabilitation. We use a variety of tools, including both state and federal tax credits, pre-development loans, various kinds of grants, and we use our bonding capacity to provide permanent financing. This is an area I would just underscore is where we often leverage private financing. We work closely with the private sector banks and investors in this arena. And we are in the middle of redesigning our competitive process that allocates these resources across the state. In our single-family areas, we do a couple of key things. We both help first-time home buyers access the opportunity for homeownership. We provide below-market rate financing vehicles, but we also provide education and pre-purchase counseling and some down payment assistance tools. And on the other end, we do a lot with a variety of tools, both state and federal, to help people stay in their homes through foreclosure avoidance and mitigation. This is an area that we can come back to that is one of the key financial drivers for the agency, because our single family loan volume, which has historically provided a lot of unrestricted revenue to us, has declined quite substantially. I did want to call out, because it's got a fair amount of conversation in the last couple of years and is in the session this year, and that is support that the state has provided through Senate Bill 1552 last year, that is the Foreclosure Avoidance Mediation Program. Our role in that is not the mediation, that's handled by the Department of Justice, but we provide a network of counseling services, outreach and communication so people know how to access a counselor, and also some legal assistance for low and moderate income people who are worried about losing their homes. In the homeownership stabilization part of our work, this is the federal grant we received a few years ago from the U.S. Department of Treasury. You may recall it's actually TARP funds. It's referred to as hardest hit funds at the national level. This came to us specifically to do foreclosure mitigation for Oregonians. We've gotten to date just almost $90 million out the door. We're on track to have that money completely spent by 2015. And then there's sort of the other part of the agency of is what you might refer to as central services. As we organize our budget, this is where this gets categorized. It includes very typical things, the director's office, human resources, and sort of business operations kinds of functions. But I would also point out that this is where we have a unit that we call policy, strategy, and community engagement. This is where our regional advisors are housed. This is our contribution, if you will, to the regional solutions centers in state government. This is also where the Oregon Volunteers Commission is housed, which is, of course, where CASA, court-appointed special advocates, is paid for.
Representative Gallegos.
Going back to the foreclosure mitigation, are you satisfied that the loophole is being closed with regard to, there was a number of banks that weren't participating or refused to participate in that mitigation process?
Yes. Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos, that's a good question. We did spend quite a bit of time, and I can say that banks and loan servicers are participating very fully now, and so we're able to.
Why are they participating now?
I think we worked out some of the operational kind of snags. There's the systems that we have to use to exchange data on the individual homeowners, and that ended up creating a lot of problems. With U.S. Treasury's assistance, we were able to smooth some of those over and create systems where we could exchange data. Turns out exchanging data can be a big barrier to getting this money out the door.
So it wasn't a matter of sanctions and that kind of thing at all?
No.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
And then the final area is where we have our bond indentures and bond-related activities, and I won't spend a lot of time on this except to say, again, this is connected to the financial drivers for our agency's transition. Over the years, we've originated, you know, thousands of mortgages for first-time homebuyers, but over time, we've also drawn several million dollars per year out of these indentures. Now, we've not placed those indentures at risk, but we have taken them out to these resources out and spent them flexibly for good purposes, but the result is we've been supplementing operations and programs with these sort of unrestricted funds, and we're unable to continue doing that for the long term. So this is a conversation I'll be going deeper with the Ways and Means Subcommittee next week, actually. Happy to follow up with any of you individually. So that's kind of a quick overview, a reminder, if you will, of what the agency does. And so now I'll turn to sort of the governor's call for change. And just a reminder that I arrived about 18 months ago with a specific charge to think about ways to improve the delivery system for housing, but community services as well, in an effort to better support these major initiatives in state government, health, education, and the like. And so it was quite an invitation to sort of think about how could we align the systems better. And so I came in and got right to work and did a pretty major reorganization of the agency fairly quickly. I had a lot of support from the governor's office and from our chief operating officer, and chose to sort of put in place an organizational structure that looks like this, and I won't show you org charts specifically, but I do want you to know that I came in, and before sort of we had this call for a major transition, I was doing a lot of substantive work to reorganize and reorient the work of the agency, and really structured the leadership team at the top around these kind of three key areas, with the idea that there's overlap if you do these each well, but there's overlap and they inform each other. So this was sort of my organizing model, if you will, for reorganization. So with that in place and us beginning to sort of work through the reorganization impacts, then it came time to prepare for the 13-15 budget process. And I guess I would characterize this, and I've had this conversation with some of you sort of individually, that it raised a series of questions for me and for my new leadership team around how do we measure outcomes? How do we integrate our programs with other things that are going on in state government? Who sets policy, and how well aligned is that policy to the rest of what state government is trying to achieve for Oregonians? And what I found in that process was, through nobody's fault, that we just weren't equipped to answer those questions. We weren't in a place where we had data, but we were asking our staff and our partners to track in particular ways so that we could see what it all added up to. And I think that was an important revelation. And then again, this deep sort of analysis of our financial structure and our business model, if you will, it became clear in the process that we had a bit of a fiscal problem that we wanted to...
Chair.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I'm curious, the DHS and the Oregon Health Agency, they're both using the lean methodologies. Are you also going to be using that? I mean, is that something you've been asked incorporate?
So, Chair Tomei and Representative Gallegos, we had done some lean processes, the very specific sort of methodology. Some of that was happening when I got there. And I would say that we're using some of the principles of that process and really driving towards understanding the process steps we take. So we had done a little bit of that, and I think we can build on the learnings from that.
Okay.
But not specifically using that tool today.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Chair, Representative Whitsitt.
Oh, Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering, on the reduced revenue available for operations, what kind of a hole are you looking at?
Chair Tomei and Representative Whitsitt, the whole, it sort of depends on if you're looking from a cash flow or a budget point of view, but we've been taking between $8 and $10 million a year, and we think we can do about that much in the 13-15 biennium and probably can't do any more after that. And so the way we've been thinking about the planning and the sort of the sequence is that we need to be on a path, a glide path, in the 13-15 biennium. And so so that in the beginning of the 15 biennium, we're restructured, if you will, in a way. So I think that's about the order of magnitude of gap.
Thank you.
So this led to the governor's balanced budget recommendation, and again, I think it's important to sort of just kind of hearken back to that. It's important for me, that is to say, to hearken back to that, that we're at this juncture and that we need to really address these fundamental challenges, but also not just see it as fixing a set of problems, but also grasping or seizing the opportunity to really better align our work and our investments with the rest of what's happening in state government.
Madam Chair.
Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director, on slide 14, I have the utmost respect for you and all the things you're doing. I hope that we've got a date here now that you're going to request in February 2014 I hope earlier than that we have discussion about a transition plan, because all those services you're providing are very important and are very fragile, vulnerable constituents. So I think the transition plan showing us that you have no gaps will be very important to your work, and I hope you remember that.
Chair Tomei and Representative Wisnes, thank you for saying that. I very much respect that and appreciate that. And in a few slides, I'll show you kind of a bit of a rudimentary timeline, if you will. And so we'll have, I plan to have a couple of check-in points with the legislature in September and December of this year, and have a lot of transparency in all the months in between, so that there will be a lot of good discussion about what are we doing and how does that feel to folks and do we have it about right yet. The idea would not be to spring it on people a year from now. Here's what we're thinking. We want to have buy-in and comfort that the plan we're putting to play in place would, or that we're recommending would fit the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much for those comments, because what I'm concerned about now is in the Early Learning Council and the youth development, in your agency too, that you have a lot of people that are nonprofits providing services. Those people providing those nonprofit services, if they know that things are changing or going away, they're going to go out and look for another job of more stability. If you're not going to be continuing them, if that's not in your plan, so you're going to lose the delivery services at the ground level if we don't know that they're going to stay or that there's going to be someone taking over, because they're going to be looking after their own job and their own family needs. If we're looking at 14 or whenever your agency goes away or realigns or whatever's going to happen. So again, I think that's very critical. I don't see happening in the other two transformations that I see. Thank you.
So, Chair Tomei and Representative Wisnet, it is my intent that we put in place a system that keeps what's really working on the ground, and that the transformation is more about state government's role, right? We talked the other day about that we sit in the middle between these streams of federal funds and the actors on the ground. And by and large, those actors on the ground do really good work. And so I think our challenge, and I'll talk a little bit more in a couple of the other slides about this point, and I think it's really critical, and I do want to highlight it, and I do want to have people continue to ask the question, how's it feeling, how's it working on the ground? I think that's very critical.
Thank you, Margaret.
So let me scroll through a couple of these sort of vision statements that I think get at some of what Representative Wisnet is talking about, and a little bit of what we touched on Wednesday of this week. And so we've tried to articulate what's wrong, or if you will, of what's the current state and how do we want it to look different. And it's not so much about anybody was being bad in the past. It is we really have to, for good reason, look to the future and think differently. So we've tried to articulate, well, what do we think needs to look different in the future? And so I've got a few of these to share. And one of them is, of course, fiscal sustainability. We're not sustainable today, so we really need to move to a service delivery model that matches cost to available resources with respect to state government's role. Today we have a system, you can think of the spaghetti chart, programs that operate independently. We really want to aim towards a system where programs are strategically aligned with state and local programs. We have a complex and costly regulatory paperwork compliance set of functions. That's what we do in Salem to a very large degree. And so how can we think differently about those paperwork requirements, about what's our true risk at the state level, and how do we monitor compliance at calibrate that at a different level so that we're really mitigating risks but not being too prescriptive about what's happening on the ground? We today, I would say to you, don't have focused outcome goals or metrics. We can talk about outputs, but we can't talk about outcomes very well. And we need to drive towards outcome-based service delivery and accountability. We need to have reporting tools and data systems that support this. I would share with you, I and my agency alone have 20 data systems, and some of them talk pretty well to each other, but not all of them. And that's not to count the side spreadsheets, the Excel spreadsheets, if you will, that people keep at their desks to just keep track of what they think they're responsible for. We've talked about this one. I have a multitude of statutorily named advisory bodies and then in addition some ad hoc work groups. I would love to see that we have a well-articulated housing agenda driven by 10-year policy outcomes that all of us could articulate and overseen by some big policy commission that would help us all think about aiming towards prosperity. Just for a quick reference, these are the eight committees. I would say not all of them were set up solely to advise my department. They advise multiple departments, some of them, but nevertheless, it makes it hard to sort of know what our North Star is, if you will. All good purpose, all good work, all good volunteer energy. What's it add up to? Another part of the vision is today we're pretty Salem focused. We make decisions in this, here in state government, especially around that biggest set of programs I mentioned, the multifamily. We really want to get to a place where we're having more deference, if you will, to those regional players. And we talked a little bit the other day about coordinated care organizations and regional solutions teams. I think this is a very important model for us to keep in mind when we think about letting locals drive policies and priorities. Along with that is fewer resources concentrated in Salem and more on the ground. So a series of next steps with transition planning, and what I have said to folks is we are planning to plan. We're just at the very early stages, so we don't actually have a plan yet. We've staked out some guiding principles. Many of our partners have also staked out some guiding principles, and happily there's a lot of really good alignment with what we've articulated and what many of our partners are beginning to articulate. The first bullet there speaks to this idea that we need to elevate the conversation about housing and anti-poverty so that it really gains prominence and is part of the larger framework of what we're doing in state government. This idea that we may need to see changes in programs, including maybe we'll stop doing this one because these other two are more effective, and we want to have those good conversations. We want to think differently about our role in mitigating risk, and maybe this is a place where we'd think about seeking waivers from the federal government if that feels appropriate. And the document that's there sort of highlighted on the side, I think, is one that I shared with you when I was before you the first time. So you've got some of this from our past conversations. Just staking out very clearly the importance of affordable housing, the importance of safety net services, and those pieces. We have to have some kind of operating assumptions or sideboards, and we've articulated a few. One of them is that at the end of the day, we do need to save money in the system, but it can't be that we save money in Salem and shift costs and burdens to locals. We're very clear about that, and our partners remind us of that all the time. We need to have a new model of decision-making and oversight, and we really need to do this in partnership with both labor and our community-based partners and stakeholders who do services on the ground. We're trying to practice as much transparency as we can. We did just this week put a new page on our website that will begin to post all the materials connected to transition. And here's that rudimentary timeline I was talking about. This year, we've already begun a lot of community engagement. This next week, we're actually going to start doing a deep analysis of programmatic elements and fiscal pieces, all the while driving towards a check-in with the legislature this fall and then again in December. And assuming the plan meets with everybody's approval in February, we would expect the second half of our biennium's funding to be authorized, and then we carry on programs and begin implementation. It's important, and we say to our staff all the time, that we need to keep the trains running, and so that's an important piece that we're trying to keep an eye on as well. So that's my presentation.
Great. Thank you, Margaret. Any other questions? Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. When you say community, you're at the community involvement stage, you're consulting the community, are you talking about the housing community or more of a public hearing local community? And the second one is, are you able to do most of this visioning with the vast, huge staff that you have, or are you bringing in others outside? Who might they be?
Chair Tomei and Representative Gilliam, it's a good question. So in terms of community engagement, I think we're going to do a variety of things. We're doing, everybody that has an interest has invited me to speak to their group and their, you know, and so I'm doing a lot of talking and listening. I expect we'll be in this building a lot for the next several months, and I think that's a piece of community engagement. To the extent I can go out to communities and hear from others, we want to be able to do that. We did think long and hard about our capacity to do this with our vast staff that I just reorganized that you noticed. I would say to you that we did decide it was in our best interest to hire a consulting firm. And so we did procure and are now starting to use the services of an outside consulting firm with experience in both the public sector and private sector. They will help us with the programmatic analytics, and they will help us with some of the community engagement.
Thank you, Margaret. I think that's the first that we've heard of that.
Yeah.
Thank you for that information. Any further questions? Thank you very much.
So do you need this?
Well, do you want me? I could click for you.
Yeah, I just have a few slides. Yeah. It's on there. So it might be just right after you.
Probably it is.
Please identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I can start. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of Neighborhood Partnerships, and I'm here today as the convener of the Housing Alliance. You've seen me a couple times with my various hats already.
How do I play the slideshow?
So I just want to talk a little bit about what you have before you the next few months, 4 months, and offer you a little bit of a framework for thinking about what the state's role is and what the legislature's role is. Margaret talked about the transition, so this is really a little bit more about what happens between now and then, and how do you think about all of these bills that are coming before you. I do want to say that we're very excited to have a committee with the name Housing in it. We're really excited to be able to have a committee that looks at the whole scope of these issues, and we very much appreciate you grappling with this and taking on this charge. So just going to go through a couple things today. I want to talk a little bit about housing need, and you've heard some about that. I want to give you maybe just a slightly different perspective, and then I'll offer you again that framework for how you think about these bills that are coming before you. So first off, you've heard a lot of testimony already about how fundamental housing is to doing all the other things that we care about as a community and as a society. So housing is fundamental to letting our aging seniors age gracefully and stay in their homes. It's fundamental to kids being successful in school. It's fundamental to all of us reaching our health outcomes. Margaret shared on Wednesday an example of Sally and Bob, who lived in Oregon City. And so one of the things that we had passed out to you today was what we call our county need sheets or housing need sheets. We have one of these for every county in the state. And I gave you Clackamas just to sort of continue the Oregon City example. And if you look up here, if you look on the left, oops, we're too. Whoops.
Okay, we're starting in the middle. I'm sorry. So this would be the income level of Sally and Bob. Sally and Bob, their take-home pay was maybe about $30,000. But you can think about Sally and Bob as one example. But another example, if you take this average annual income for a school bus driver, which is the left-hand column in the middle of that chart, that could be Carlos, who has a wife who has health problems and one child. So they need a certain kind of housing situation. If you look at the right-hand column in that same group with a bank teller, that could be Laura, who's a single mom with one kid. If you look at that, if you have the papers in front of you, I can't show you the slide, unfortunately, because we seem to have a problem. But you're looking then at folks who have very, very low incomes. So you might have Tom, for example, a retired man, 72 years old, living on Social Security, who's lucky to be pretty healthy. So he's not going to have service needs necessarily. We'll just call it a failure. You might have someone who is on a disability pension. And what these charts are illustrating is that the incomes for these folks who live in very different life circumstances do not reach far enough to meet their housing needs. And the red lines at the tops of all those charts are what you would need to pay for that average housing cost. So the final slide, and then we're going to just totally give up on this and go to my pretty pictures.
Tana, I want to stop okay. there. So are you saying that an average, to rent an average two-bedroom apartment would be $3,000 a month? Did I sort of assume that from that slide?
So that would be the month, the
average $35,640, the average income needed to afford a two-bedroom apartment.
Right. So if we think about the Clackamas County, Oregon City example, that two-bedroom apartment probably costs about $900 a month. So we're looking at what the median rent level would be in that community, what's affordable, okay. paying a third of your income for rent. And
you.
That's
Thank
where
you.
We're seeing the gap.
Question.
Let's go to the Let's go to the pictures.
Representative Whitfitt?
Yeah, I just had a follow-up on that, if I may. What is the cost of an average home in Clackamas County?
So that's the number on the right side there, and that would be $259,600.
Okay.
And
all right, sorry.
I will note that these are really current numbers. We got these from the multiple listing service like last October and November. The good news is with the foreclosure crisis, homeownership is more affordable. The bad news is we have a foreclosure crisis. But and again, we have these for every county, and we can make sure that you have those. They've been turned in previously electronically to the committee. So my point is we have housing that's unaffordable, but we also have this variety of needs. And we often talk about it, as Margaret did, as sort of a linear continuum that goes from folks who are struggling to remain stable in housing and to not be homeless, all the way to folks that are trying to build assets for their families and get into home ownership. But it's also a little bit like popcorn. You know, it's in one community, you've got folks with very, very different needs. And that's why when we talk about how complicated housing and community services, that's the reason that we have that very, very complex spaghetti chart, is that, you know, you've got aging seniors living next door to young families and people with different kinds of medical needs and service needs. And that's the web of complexity that we need a system to address. So how do you think about this then as legislators, as policies come before you? And this is where we get to go to the pretty pictures, which may or may not appear on that PowerPoint.
I'm sorry about this. So if we're looking at our goal of ensuring housing opportunity across Oregon, so every county of this state, every community in this state, meeting all of that complex variety of housing needs, we think of all of the things that the Housing Alliance is bringing forward to you to think about, all of our legislative proposals, could fit neatly into three kinds of categories. And that's what these next few, that's what these pictures illustrate and what my next few pages illustrate. So we need more housing. So we put that in the build category. We need more housing at all income levels, in all communities, for all of those kinds of life circumstances that pop up over the course of life cycles. We need that housing to match the huge variety of income levels that we have. And we in the Housing Alliance are particularly concerned about ensuring that we meet the housing needs of folks who don't have adequate incomes. So we're particularly concerned at how do we keep folks stable in housing? How do we get people into housing suitable for their life cycle if they have very limited incomes? And we are very aware that the needs are all the way from shelter, from emergency shelter, to homeownership. The second category that we would use would be preservation, or to preserve. And you'll hear housing advocates talk about preservation of existing federally subsidized housing. That's, you know, one category of preservation. But preservation also means eviction prevention, keeping people stable in the housing that they have. It also means foreclosure mitigation, not that foreclosures won't happen, but that people should be, graceful exits should be facilitated if a foreclosure is inevitable. So we don't want people evicted out on the street, desperately searching for housing. We want to facilitate easy transfers. We want to prevent homelessness where we can. We also, so we can't afford to lose any of the affordable housing that we have. We also get really valuable matching federal resources, and so we would ask that you think about policy decisions in terms of preserving those really precious matching resources and streams of money. The third category then would be increasing access, and those would be more policy tools that look to create those public-private partnerships that help us move beyond what the small amounts of subsidy that we have available allow us to do. We will always, as sort of the affordable housing community, be at the edges of the market. We can't influence the whole market, but we do have tools that we can use that allow us to work with the market and reduce barriers that folks may have to getting into housing and help the market better serve the whole community. So just a little more specifics on the next three pages that you have in your handout. What I've done is I've listed the tools under the build category. I've listed the tools that currently exist as state funding mechanisms, as statutory tools, and then I've just sort of reminded you that many of these tools are created to be easy to layer, because if you layer tools on top of one another, if you think of the example of the Rockwood property that was shown to you on Wednesday with the many, 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 many funding sources, the many partners coming together, that's all done in an effort to increase the richness of the services available to folks living in and near that property. It's also done to decrease the rents that have to be charged to the residents of that property. So we try to, when we think about tools and the utility of tools, we want to make them easy to layer on top of one another and use together. And that is something that we all hope will come out of the transformation that Margaret is talking about. So on this list, I won't go through the whole list, but on the list, I tried to italicize things that I know will come before your committee. Some of them are tools that exist that you won't be thinking about this session, but maybe thinking about in future sessions. So then the next, under preservation, again, preventing homelessness and displacement, it won't come to you, but there's a budget item for the emergency housing account, which is our biggest tool to do that. You've heard some talk of that kind of work and kind of effort within the Veterans Housing Bill. Manufactured home park preservation, which is actively in front of you. And then a couple other bills that probably won't come to you but are related about existing subsidized housing and foreclosure mitigation. And then finally, that sort of policy bucket, which can also tie in with money. The biggest issue coming before you this session would be the bill to maximize the utility of the tenant-based Section 8 program. But that's an example of a policy program that is looking at reducing barriers for low-income tenants. So I apologize for the technical difficulties, but hope that that framework is useful to you as you do the work ahead of you this session. And again, I just want to say how much we really appreciate having a committee that's looking at the breadth and scope of this issue.
Thank you so much, Janet. Any questions? Representative Wisnett?
I was wondering, under statutory tools on the build, enabling legislation for property tax abatement, what does that mean?
Chair Tomei, Representative Witsit, you had a bill in front of you that's a good example of that. I believe it's 2439. It was the bill that the City of Portland brought forward to continue or extend the sunset on their single-family home ownership program. So it's typically those, and there are a number of statutory enabling statutes that let local governments create those kinds of abatement programs.
Representative Gelfi?
Yes, thank you. I really liked these handouts a lot, and I'm wondering where we can access them for our own communities and if it would be possible to get electronic copies of these that we could have in OLIS.
Yes, so Chair Tomei, Representative Gelser, we have submitted them electronically. I'll make sure that Debbie gets those again. We would be happy to provide them. And they're also on the Housing Alliance webpage if you have anybody that's interested in looking them up.
Are they?
The statistics are really amazing.
Thank you.
I don't. They're not. Follow up. They're not there.
They're not on OLIS?
They're not on OLIS. So the first PowerPoint was there, but the other...
Okay. We'll make sure that it is.
Is it just the pictures that are missing on it? It's there, but no pictures on it?
She emailed me something that had the same information, but it didn't have the pictures and stuff. I'll rescan what she's handed.
Chair Tomei, and we'll be sure that you get the full set in a PDF.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Janet, this committee is looking at a bill that's very important to the leadership of the House, and I'm going to try to give it due respect. Can you give us, do you have the information on the utilization of Section 8? Can you provide information on which counties are using Section 8? Can you give us information on what size of properties? To be honest with you, and to the committee and the chair, my concerns are the small owners that have two or three properties, and also you wouldn't probably have any information about damage or how much any reports from people doing Section 8 and how much damage is the average or whatever.
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, I appreciate those questions. I believe that we can answer some of those questions. We do certainly have information about the utilization of Section 8 by county. I do not believe that I can get you information about the size of properties that those are used in, though I'd be happy to speak with Housing Works and see if they've got some information they can share. On the damages and the risk mitigation, there have been several risk mitigation pools set up. There have been, there's one that's managed currently by Housing and Community Services. There is one that is managed currently by Home Forward in the Multnomah County, City of Portland area. And then there's one that was set up specifically by the City of Portland to address, they had a program to take people off the streets from homelessness. And so folks with very serious mental health and other issues, and there was a risk mitigation pool set up. And I do have data on the claims for all of those, some of it from Housing and Community Services. I'd be happy to share that. The experience is that there are actually very few claims made. And we are very committed as advocates, and I know the speaker is as well, to creating that risk mitigation pool. The department has identified a pot of money to fund that. So that's something that we take very seriously.
Thank you very much.
And we'll have it sent to the full committee. Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I want to thank you very much for your presentation, and I think it certainly helped me, and I hope the rest of the committee, to see what we're dealing with and where we wish to go with this. I do have a couple of questions. I'm not sure which Ways and Means you're going to go to, and certainly this is not a Ways and Means committee, but I am curious about the, if you could put a figure on the, I mean, I can just imagine there's a ton of jobs that are involved here with your partners, with the the employment of all of these folks, and I just wonder at how much revenue that generates, one for the state, or even for these individuals in terms of incomes and salaries and so on. And like I said, I'm sure that that would be an interesting figure to look at. The other thing is in your planning, I do hope that these partners can certainly are going to be involved from the ground up in terms of the planning process, because I think, as I mentioned the other day, I know there's a lot of anxiety about how this planning is going to roll out and so on. So do look forward to, as I said, seeing that these partners are part of that planning process. But thank you, thank you.
Yes, thank you both very much. You've been very, very helpful helping us learn about the housing situation and how we can be helpful to you and to the other partners.
Thank
Any
you.
Further questions? Thank you. We look forward to seeing you in the future. With that, we will close the informational hearing on housing, and we will open up a public hearing on House Bill 2671.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 2671 has no revenue impact, and a fiscal statement was issued. It creates the State Office of the Public Guardian and Conservator to provide public guardian and conservator services for persons without relatives or friends willing or able to serve as guardians or conservators. It directs the governor to appoint public guardian and conservator as administrative head of office. It prescribes duties and responsibilities of public guardian and conservator in office. It requires the office to certify and train deputy public guardians and conservators. It requires office to develop volunteer program to assist office, imposes certain limitations on court orders and proceedings brought by office, and establishes public guardian and conservator advisory committee. It renames existing offices of public guardian and conservator as county offices of public guardian and conservator. It creates the State Office of the Public Guardian and Conservator Fund and continuously appropriates monies to fund in the fund to the State Office of the Public Guardian and Conservator.
Great. Representative Dembro, I know you're here. There you are.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Michael Dembro, I represent House District 45. That's Northeast Portland out to Park Rose. And it's great to be back with Human Services. Actually, the bill that I'm presenting to you today dates back to my first term in office when I sat on this committee, the good old days when Rep. Olson was, well, not much has changed. He was the vice chair then, as I recall.
What do you mean by that?
It was a great committee. I miss it deeply. However, you know, it was one of those committees where the gifts just keep on giving, because Representative Tomei asked me to serve on a task force dealing with the issue of public guardianship and conservatorship. And as you know, when Rep. Tomei asks, you must say yes. That task force was formed and began meeting in September of 2009 and has continued to be working on this issue. Last session in 2011, we extended the sunset of the task force so that it could continue to do this work. And this work, I came to learn, is a very, very serious issue. And it has to do with the growing number of people who have a need for a guardian, that is, someone who can make life decisions on their behalf. Medical decisions, housing decisions, things like that, because they don't have the capacity to do that due to things like Alzheimer's or mental illness or some disability, and they are so indigent that they don't have the means or the family members to do those guardianship services or to hire a professional guardian. Multnomah County has a program that does that work. It's a public guardianship and conservatorship program, but it is the only county in the state that has such a program. And yet the need for the services of a public guardian and conservator, that is someone to take control of the financial decisions that need to be made on the person's behalf, the other counties don't have that. And this is a very serious problem and a growing problem. Fortunately, a really stellar group of people were brought together, myself excluded from that, who work on this, on the ground, attorneys, a former judge headed the task force, and a current judge was part of it, district attorney, someone from Disability Rights Oregon, just a real range of individuals, to work to come up with a model that really would serve Oregon well, and that would not only help to make guardianship decisions for affected individuals, but also would make sure that these decisions were being made truly in the best interests of the individuals, respecting their need for their capacity to make independent decisions and to have them be involved in the least restrictive settings possible. It was a real pleasure. I had to give up my place on that task force last session because I had other things that I had to do, but I remain passionate about it, and I'm very excited to be presenting the work of the task force and the recommendation, which is this bill, that you'll get to hear from those who've been directly involved in its creation.
Thank you very much, Representative Dembrough. Any quick questions? Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Dembrough, for working on this issue. I know you were on that task force for a while, and I've recently had communications from a number of people that are concerned about the cost related to obtaining a guardianship, particularly on the education side. I've talked with some educators who have seen families that have children who turn 18 that cannot afford to go through the guardianship process, and therefore they are now excluded from all school planning for their students, essentially leaving their students without an advocate, even if the students are nonverbal. Has there been any discussion in that task force about scholarships or payment assistance for the legal fees that are involved in both that initial obtaining, whatever that word is, getting of the guardianship, and then the annual renewal so that guardians can be a person that that individual knows and trusts?
Mm-hmm. I think you'll have to ask that. I'm sorry, Chair Tomei, Rep. Gelser, you'll need to ask that question of the people who come after me. It's a good question.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of questions. Well, Representative Dembrough, it's good to see you here again. Hey, I'm just kind of curious. It kind of follows up a little bit with what Representative Gelser was just asking, but I'm when you were doing your homework on this, and I don't have an idea at all, what's a ballpark figure on the average cost for transaction or guardianship?
Well, I don't know. You know, these are long-standing relationships that are created, and you know, I think Jeff Brandon is probably going to testify. He used to work before he retired. He worked for a long time for the Multnomah County program, where I think they had an annual budget of about $1 million, and I'm not sure the number of people that they served, but I would ask him that question. But again, these are not like one-time transactions. These, you know, these go on for years.
Okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate that. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Okay, thanks. I'm reading through the fiscal impact, and I get the part for having Department of Justice being involved. They don't get and understand state police being involved.
Maybe we could ask
There's right.
People who would be speaking. Okay. That's great.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Great.
Okay.
Well, I just want to have the opportunity to put them on the spot.
I know you do. I know. I'm trying to save them.
Yeah. You know, when we met, Chair Tomei, it was 8 o'clock in the morning. I think you're... it's tough on a Friday afternoon, but on the other afternoons, it's, I'm sure, much easier. As Rep. Olson remembers, coming to this meeting at 8:01 a venial sin, if not a mortal sin.
On a Monday
sin.
Morning.
That's it was right. Great. It was great.
You know, okay. That costs revenue.
Thank you, colleagues. And,
thank
and
you
let me
very
say
much.
Before I leave that, that the next bill that you'll be hearing actually deals with a related element of this problem.
Did you want to testify on that one?
I'll wait around. I want to hear this.
You can wait around.
Yes.
Terrific.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. We're going to be calling a group of people, Becky Strickland, Judge Betsy Welch, Jan Friedman, and Holly Berman. And then we'll have three people after that. I want to remind you we have another bill today, and I've promised the committee we'd get out at 4:45. So just... And we have lots of written information, so I'm asking you not to read your written information. If you would just summarize it and make your strong points, and we will read the information that you have provided for our packets.
Sorry, we'll be right back.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming. Thanks for all your work on this. Representative Wisher.
Thank you. We're not going to do a work session.
No, we're not doing a work
session
today.
We'll have another opportunity.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you so much for coming.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Elizabeth Welch. I'm a senior circuit court judge, and I'm the chair of this wonderful group. I was the chief family and probate judge in Multnomah County for 12 years, and as a result became familiar with the public guardian program in Portland. And after I retired, I had to do Plan B, right, all over the place, visiting courts all over the state, which was a very positive experience, by the way, and came to really recognize what do these communities do with the kind of people we're talking about here, and I will expand on that as well, my co-panelists here, when there isn't a public guardian. And the answer is there isn't anything to do. These are folks that are just out there hanging out in every community. I have been the chair of this body since it started, and I have also worked on the Supreme Court Task Force on protective proceedings. So I'm really into this stuff, and this is just a vitally important thing, and I hope that you will ask questions and or invite us back to talk about it, because it's important that you understand who we are talking about. As you know, that the bill establishes a state office, the governor appoints a director. The critical things I want to say, taking your admonition to move along, about the statute itself is that there is an intake process that is described in the appendix to our report to the legislature. I don't believe you got the appendix when you got the report. It's just a few more pages, and I will hope you will get that and have the opportunity to look at. And Holly Berman the former public guardian in Multnomah County, will tell you about that process. It's really critical to your understanding of what this is all about. This program is for adults with the most acute forms of developmental disability, mental illness, dementia, traumatic brain injury, who, and a subset of that large group of folks is people who are severe enough that they lack the capacity to make the basic decisions for their safety and health and welfare, and are thereby endangered. All of those elements have to be present as a matter of law for a guardianship to be established by a court. Now, normally in guardianship matters, family members serve, an overwhelming majority of guardians are family members or family friends, and that's favored by law. But sometimes there isn't anybody to do that, or unfortunately, very frequently, the family's the problem, to be blunt. And that's not a solution. Now, if people have resources, they can get a professional fiduciary by expending family funds. But again, there's you have left these people. Now, if you think about mental illness, mental disability, developmental disability, Alzheimer's, dementia, and traumatic injury, and think of the people who are the most severe in their condition that they have, what are the resources in the state for those people? And the answer would be, we'll say, well, mental commitment. Mental commitment is not really a solution. Mental commitment is, in the overwhelming majority of circumstances, a very brief stay in a facility. And then the people are released, usually, hopefully on medication that will help them, because only people who can be committed of our group that we're talking about are people who are mentally ill, as distinct from the other categories that I've mentioned. These are some of the people that we're talking about, the people who have been committed or could be committed, for whom guardianship is an alternative or is a necessity for them to be able to function in the community. The one of the many frustrations in trying to put this together is lack of data. Nationally, data is terrible because public agencies do not keep track of people they can't help. It's just an unfortunate fact. But we know that the folks we're talking about represent a tremendous drain on police services, emergency services, hospitals, and the whole social services system of the state. We believe that there are somewhere in the vicinity of somewhere between 1,500 and 3,200 people not in this state who need these services who are not currently getting them. Our proposal would serve maybe 300 to 350 people, so it's only a 10% of the projected population of folks we're talking about. I would like to introduce Jan Friedman, who will speak next.
Thank you, Judge Wells. I'm Jan Friedman, and I'm a staff attorney with Disability Rights Oregon, which is the federally funded nonprofit protection and advocacy law office for people with disabilities in our state. And I'm also a member of this Public Guardian Task Force, and have been since its inception. And I think I'm a member of the task force because for the last over 13 years, every one of my clients is a person with a disability, and some of those people are people who are under guardianship. While Disability Rights Oregon works to protect people's rights to self-determination and maximum independence, there are times when people need assistance in making decisions about the most basic things in their life, their housing, their health care, those sorts of things. And those situations are one where, under the statute, the person is mentally incapacitated if they're incapable of making decisions. So information comes in, they can't process it. And it's to such a degree that they're in serious likelihood of having physical harm or illness. These also are people who oftentimes are victims of abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation, or maybe a combination of those. They're people who don't, they're not really part of the community. They don't have friends, they don't have family, they don't have acquaintances, they don't have people they can ask to step up to be a guardian. And also they're indigent. They're not able to retain a private guardian or a conservator to step up. So a state office of public guardian and conservator is uniquely designed to provide the sort of long-term protection and assistance that these people need. Like Judge Welch said, civil commitment, the maximum time is 180 days. On a guardianship, somebody has a guardian for life unless some sort of court action is taken to stop that. So these are people who are in dire straits. They're in acute need. They're frequently isolated and unseen in our communities. Disability Rights Oregon supports House Bill 2671 because there are victims and they're getting hurt and they're in this situation, and it's a needed last-ditch, least restrictive alternative for those people in the community. Like Judge Welch said, there's, you know, the program would start at least with some of them. We're not going to reach all of them. I'm going to give an example of a client that Disability Rights Oregon represented. I'll call her Sarah. Sarah is a woman in her 30s who lives in a rural community, and she lives with her mother and stepfather. Her mother and stepfather are precluding anyone from disability. I'm sorry, I need to tell you a little bit about her. She's a woman who has intellectual disability. She's functioning at the level of a five-year-old. She's nonverbal and she's blind. And the parents are precluding people from disability services to come in, or any case manager, anyone to work with her. So there is question about what is the quality of care that Sarah's receiving. There also becomes allegations about her stepfather, the stepfather's son, and the neighbor who's a registered sex offender sexually abusing Sarah. So Disability Rights Oregon gets involved working to get her out of that situation and get her to an assessment. There's no public guardian office in this rural county, and what happens is Disability Rights Oregon coalitions with the ARC of Oregon, with Developmental Disability Services, and they get the judge to order a temporary protective service order, basically, which allowed them to take Sarah out of her house, get her to the evaluation, get her to the assessment, where they found out that there was long-term abuse, long-term neglect. She came in, she had infections, she had severe conjunctivitis, and she was malnourished. And eventually, it took some additional time to find a guardian for Sarah. Meantime, had there been a state office of public guardian and conservator in place, then that rural county could have petitioned for an emergency guardian, and Sarah could have been out of harm's way much more readily than she was. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So Becky Strickland will talk next.
Madam Chair and Committee, my name is Becky Strickland. I'm a program supervisor in Lane County for Senior and Disabled Services, and I supervise the Adult Protective Service Unit, and I have for 13 years. So I've seen some pretty horrific cases in which people have been abused and neglected. I'm here to talk to you about a couple cases that have been close to my heart since the day we got involved. And the first one I want to speak about is, her name's Ethel, or I'll call her Ethel. And she is 81 years old, and she was brought to the attention of our office through the utility company. One of our local utility companies called to say that they were going to shut off her electricity because she had a $1,000 bill that she was not paying or had not been paying. And they wanted to alert us that she also was an oxygen user. And so we kindly asked them to postpone any arrangements they planned to shut it off until we could get out there to assess her. When we got out there, we met a real frail, obviously sick woman living in a pretty modest home with her two dogs and or three dogs and two cats. Ethel was reluctant to you know, talk to us. You know, we were the government, except when we shared with her that we were there to help her because we had heard her electricity might be turned off. In talking with her, she'd been fairly independent up until she got ill. She didn't know why she was on oxygen. She preferred to stay away from the medical community, had lived on a modest income all of her life, and felt that going to the doctor on a frequent basis was excessive. Anyway, as we got to know Ethel and develop a relationship with her, we realized the home that was next door to her was also occupied by renters, that it was a known methamphetamine house. And we learned that they had been, they had taken their electrical cords from their home and plugged them into her home and had been siphoning off her electricity for quite a long time. And she had gotten to the point where she couldn't afford to pay the bill, so she just stopped. So knowing that she was quite sick, we tried to put some friendly visitors in, build a relationship, and offer her services. She accepted some in-home meals, was not interested in the Medicaid program or receiving services. Yet each visit, we could see that she was deteriorating, and not only physically, but also mentally. And she was getting more confused. She was beginning to spend most of her time in bed, unable to care for our animals. We called the EMTs multiple times to come and assess her and see if we could get her transported to the hospital. She refused. They wouldn't transport her. We even asked the commitment team to go out and see if they could do a an emergency hold just to get her to the hospital for an evaluation. That didn't work. So we made frequent visits. And again, as over time, within the 18 months that we were involved, she continued to deteriorate to the point that she became pretty incapacitated. On some of our last few visits, we noticed that this nice, neat, tidy home that she'd been living in was becoming kind of a disaster. And we had reason to believe that somebody was starting to occupy another part of her house. And because she was confined to her bedroom, she seldom came out. We had the meals driver would leave the meals on the front porch, and we assumed she was getting them. However, she was having significant weight loss. We later learned that those people that had occupied the house next door had vacated it when we started involving the police and soon started occupying her home. And we began to see animal feces, urine, dishes piled high, drug paraphernalia. And we continued to see her, try to convince her to go with us to the hospital and get appropriate care. And she refused. At this, the last visit, I accompanied the APS worker on the visit because it had declined so bad that she was saying, we got to do something. And had we had a public guardian or someone that we could have accessed, we would have been able to honor her wishes, which it was clear to us she wanted to remain in her home, and that those animals were the only thing that she had to live for. And that would have been our goal, would have been to seek some public guardian to help us execute that plan and get rid of the people who were taking advantage of her. The day that we went out there, there was so much feces and blood on the floor that literally we were on our tiptoes getting to her bedroom, where her oxygen tubing laid across the floor in this urine and feces. Mm-hmm. And she was bleeding. Her bed was filled with blood, and she was incontinent. And at that time, we were able to get her out of there in the hospital, learned that she had metastatic breast cancer that had metastasized to her brain and lungs. And unfortunately, she left the hospital and then 2 weeks later died in a nursing home. And if we had had a public guardian, I know that we could have helped her to live a dignified life, die in her own home, and not being taken advantage of like she was the last 18 months of her life.
Thank you so much. That's a very sad story. And colleagues, these are the kinds of stories that we heard 4 years ago that brought us to this point that we thought we needed to do something.
Can I talk about Daniel?
No.
Okay. Sorry. Okay.
Go ahead.
Can I drink this? Oh, why don't I just move?
Thanks. we have three more people to testify after this.
Okay. Thank you for being here on this Friday afternoon. Thank you for what you do. My name is Holly Berman. I'm a private practice social worker working with families and professional guardians. I teach guardianship classes at Portland Community College. I'm also a member of the Public Guardian Task Force. I was the public guardian for Multnomah County for 18 years. I retired in 2009. I'm not representing Multnomah County today because they have a public guardian program. This is the program that would be for the rest of the state. And I was asked to explain how public guardianship impacts the service system and the community. 9 out of 10 individuals referred for guardianship don't actually require guardianship. They require really sophisticated care planning, and so part of the role of the public guardian is to work with police, abuse investigators, mental health commitment staff, and hospitals to solve problems without having to resort to guardianship. Every case that's successfully diverted can potentially save.
I'm going to stop you. We have your written information
okay.
in our packets. If you would summarize it, that would be really helpful.
Okay. It saves many tax dollars. There's a case example in there of a woman who was with a top 911 user in Multnomah County for the year before I retired. She did something like 120 911 visits at several thousand dollars apiece. She was the highest emergency room user in two different hospital systems they didn't know. And she had many hospital admissions, so this is what she was doing when she wasn't in the hospital. She had advanced dementia, leg ulcers, none of which she could care for because she had Alzheimer's. Just one case example of how incredibly much public money and private money and hospital money went into a problem that the year after we took guardianship, she had one emergency room visit, and that was it. She was in a facility. She was happy. Her needs were met. In every community, there are a few cases that are just really serious abuse or neglect, and guardianship right now is the only tool we have for those people. It's a service of extreme last resort. In Multnomah County, less than 1% of the people in the service system were ever even considered for guardianship. It's a really tip of the iceberg kind of program. This bill would spread a very thin layer of service across the remainder of the state. The states that surround us have really complete geographic statewide programs, California and Washington, Utah. What we're hoping to do is develop a program that can cover the parts of the state that are not Multnomah County with at least some level of service. So thank you for considering making that available to the rest of Oregon.
And thank you all for being on this group that I know put in many, many hours on this issue, and we're hoping we're going to be able to do something this legislative session to help this population. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I put something on the record quickly?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for being here. And
could
I just
you hold it just a second?
I'm
going to call some people up, and they can be seated while you're doing this. Mike McCormick, Fred Steele, and Matt Evans. So
good.
Now go ahead.
And Fred might actually talk to this as well. As you know, Madam Chair, we're going to work on our second elder abuse prevention bill. And Judge, I, with the work that you've done and where we're heading with this bill, I hope that you will come, if possible, to the next meeting of our elder abuse prevention group. And if Regina will help me, we'll get everybody coordinated on information. We would love for you to talk to this group about the work that you're going to do and talk about our two bills. The issues, the seriousness of it, and the accomplishments that you have so far are perfect for what we're working on, and I would welcome your assistance. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
you, Representative. Okay, and if you would just identify yourself, that would be great.
Oh, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike McCormick, and I'm the Deputy Director for DHS Aging and People with Disabilities. I'll be very brief. I'm going to...
We do have written materials from you, right?
No.
Oh,
not
okay.
From me.
Okay.
I want to reiterate that the department is neutral on this bill, as the funding associated with it was not included in the governor's recommended budget. But reiterate that... Oregon has a very robust in-home service support service system, and a lot of that can be attributed to services such as guardianship. So I'm going to just reiterate that that is the most important outcome of the agency.
Okay. Fred. Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Fred Steele. I am what is referred to as the state legal services developer under the Older Americans Act at the Department of Human Services. There is written testimony from the department. That's my written testimony. I was the ADHS representative, a department representative on the Public Guardian and Conservator Task Force. And it's in that capacity that wanted to come before you and take this opportunity to just spend a minute or two with you. In my position as the legal services developer, my role is to identify and promote opportunities to ensure and enhance the rights, independence, dignity, and safety of older Oregonians, but then that's from my Older Americans Act obligations, but then also within the state and within the department, looking at all vulnerable adults in Oregon. It's that independence, dignity, and safety that I just wanted to focus on. You heard a lot of that from the previous panel. Mike referencing our in-home care, community-based care, long-term care support services programs that a guardian in place can enhance the independence and dignity in particular. I think the safety issue and getting a guardian or conservator in place is more simply understood, but for that independence and dignity, it's counterintuitive with a guardianship because you're technically taking away rights from somebody, but an appropriately limited guardian, which is the baseline or the starting point for any guardianship that's put in place, is ideally, you know, putting that guardian conservator in a position to represent the best interests of somebody that needs it. And in our system, in DHS, and our long-term care services and support systems, if we can have an individual that doesn't have those family members, doesn't have the private funding for their own private guardian, that they can ideally be placed in a lower level of care and to promote their own independence and dignity so that they can live. So just real quickly, the two things that I want to leave you with is, as I'm prone to do, take you back 32 years to your predecessors in 1981, Legislative Assembly there. And I want to read this because I like to. It's almost as close to statutory poetry as you can get. It's in ORS 410.010. It says, in keeping with the traditional concept of the inherent dignity of the individual in our democratic society, and then it goes on to talk about preserving for older citizens and people with disabilities in Oregon to preserve their health, honor, dignity, maximize freedom and independence. This bill, this concept of the public guardianship concept will take us towards that for individuals in Oregon that need it. Lastly, just taking you to yesterday, and Senate Concurrent Resolution 1, which is the legislature supporting, and it passed the House yesterday, and applaud you for that, but supporting the state plan for Alzheimer's disease in Oregon. I was on one of the subgroups that contributed a small portion, but contributed a portion to that plan, and just thinking of that population and how a public guardian conservative program relates to what you were considering yesterday on the House floor. So thank you. Yeah,
thank you, Chair.
Question, somebody was asking if they thought they might ask of Fred Steele. Is that yours?
If I could, Chair Tomei, members of the committee, Representative Gilliam, yes, I've been a member, or at least in the first iteration in the fall of 2011 on the Elder Abuse Work Group. In the past year, also served on the Resident Safety Review Council that was a product of House Bill 4084 in February 2012, and have been working with Representative Gilliam, Representative Hoyle, and the wonderful members of that committee. The public guardian conservator issue is very much an elder abuse issue, and we heard that on the previous panel, especially from Becky Strickland, in particular with the Adult Protective Services work she does in Lane County. So,
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I'm here today representing the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. I wanted to use this opportunity to highlight probably the second greatest problem that adult foster homes face in Oregon, and that has to do with rules and regulations. Currently, state law does not require local regulators to follow state rules. They have to
do that as a minimum, but they can go beyond those rules as they set up their own systems. The problem this creates, of course, is the stereotypical crazy quilt of rules across the state where you can have an adult foster home located in Clackamas County and across the street another one located in Multnomah County, and they can be operating under two completely different sets of rules. So I just want to caution on this particular bill that the rules set up by the advisory board should be made statewide in character, and any local jurisdiction that would like to set up conservators and guardianships should be required to follow the rules that the state provides. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any quick questions? Thank you very much. Colleagues, this is an issue we've been hearing about for, I think, 4 or 5 years, and as Representative Olson was referring to earlier, it does have a pretty big fiscal. Maybe we can work together with Representative Dimbrough and maybe Representative Doherty, I think, who was the chief sponsor of this legislation. Maybe we can see what we can do to bring it down so it might be more palatable to the Ways and Means Committee, because I think it's an important piece of legislation. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there someone in DHS that we could go to for further background or questions other than Representative Dimbrough or Doherty?
We'll look into that.
See if there's someone in DHS. And
I think the
gentleman that worked on the abuse lawyer that would.
Karen, you can help us with that?
Good laser.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Yes.
Right there.
My understanding that you won't be up here? Can
I
ask some questions?
Madam Chair.
Did you have a question?
I'm just saying that who in the state, you know, DHS, or who should we go to get more background, and people are not familiar with this in the past, and ask them data. I seem to get the feeling that DHS is saying that they're neutral on the bill, which is, that means there's some concern about the money or something in the issue. So.
Chair Tomei, Representative Wisnett, again, Steele, with the Department of Human Services. My understanding is that the department is neutral, as the funding and the fiscal that's associated with this bill is not in the governor's recommended budget. But as far as following up and getting additional information, it would come from at least a few of the different divisions within the department, but we can definitely follow up with any answers to get some better understanding of costs associated with guardianships, how it impacts long-term care, abuse.
Thank you. Okay, with that, we're going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 2671. And again, I want to thank you those of you who worked on this issue for so many years and spent many, many hours on a very, very difficult issue. Thank you so much. With that, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 2671. Open up the first public hearing on House Bill 3129.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 3129 has no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact. The statement has not been issued. It has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. It creates the State Board of Professional Fiduciaries within the Department of Human Services to adopt rules for professional fiduciaries. It mandates the board to adopt a code of conduct for professional fiduciaries, and it directs the Department of Human Services to certify professional fiduciaries.
Representative Dimbrough, I think this is one of the traditional gut and stuffs. Is that correct?
You've got it, Madam Chair.
Right.
Yes.
For the freshmen, you want to explain to them what that is?
Okay. So first of all, I'm Michael Dimbrough again, represent House District 45. And what we have here is, as the chair mentioned, a gut and stuff, where we have a set of amendments. The dash one amendments are the bill that we're asking you to consider. The issue here was something that flowed out of the work of the task force, as well as, frankly, the work done by the Alzheimer's, the state plan task force, and that is dealing with the issue of people who need guardians, who do have the means to hire professional guardians, but the need to make sure that these guardians are doing their job and have the proper credentials and certifications and are not setting up the person needing the guardian services for abuse or exploitation. This is, I think, again, a related issue to the Elder Abuse Task Force. It's a real challenge that we face. In its original form, we had considered creating a state board of professional fiduciaries, and, you know, upon reflection, it seems that, we may not be ready for that yet. And part of the thinking there was that, you know, this state board would develop the certification standards that we need for professional guardians. There do already exist certification standards. There are national certification standards in place that you'll hear about that are, you know, quite appropriate and that we could piggyback on. You'll hear more about those. What the bill now also does is it sets up a work group to look at ongoing professional development for professional fiduciaries, what's appropriate in order to make sure that, you know, again, that we can trust them. And, you know, there's also an interest in coming up with training for, you know, ultimately for non-professional fiduciaries, family members who find themselves in the position of having to be a guardian of a family member, but who really don't have the training or the access to professional development needed to be able to really navigate the system. So that's what this bill is. You know, I think that with the changes in the Dash 1 amendment, that should bring the fiscal way down. We'll see what happens with that. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions, or in the few minutes remaining, you can hear from the professionals.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I see Representative Dimbro at the very end of the Section 3 that the work is completed by, well, it looks like anyways, January 2nd, 2016, and then you have a report then at that time?
Yes, okay, that's right. Report and recommendations.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I would call up Judge Betsy Welch, Michael Osue, is it? And Nancy Doty. After this, we'll have Nancy McDonald and Kevin Burke. Welcome back.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I will be super quick.
Thank you.
1994, I became the chief probate judge in Multnomah County. And was shocked to see that anybody, all you have to do is say, I am a guardian. And you can get paid and have total control over someone else's life and over someone else's finances. And there are absolutely no requirements in the state for what training you have, what background you have, what anything. Bonding is required by the court when you're appointed, but that's it. That hasn't changed. What's changed is there are now self-imposed standards that all these fine people have subjected themselves to. But the idea that a court could appoint a person to have that kind of power in someone else's life without having any idea of whether they know what they're doing, have any skills, have anything. They do record checks under the existing law. I will stop because these folks have more important things they want to say. There are many, many fine professional fiduciaries in this state, and they're some of the best are in this room right now. But this is an issue that needs to be addressed, and a statute that says no judge can appoint someone who is not certified seems like a nice step in the right direction. Thank you. If there are no questions, I'll just be quiet.
Thank you.
You're
thank
the
you
judge.
Madam Chair, ladies and gentlemen of the panel, my name is Nancy Doty, and I have been a professional fiduciary since 1988. In 1988, some colleagues and I, including Jeff Brandon, who is on the previously mentioned committee, and Nancy McDonald, who is also in the room today, started our own Guardian Conservator Association with standards and a code of ethics because we really wanted to do a good job. We wanted to be trustworthy, we wanted to be honorable, and we wanted to assure our clients that they would get the best possible service. We have tried very hard to manage our own destiny in this career path, but we come from so many varied backgrounds, engineering, finance. I was a former nurse, legal, financial, all kinds of different backgrounds. And one of our goals was to establish a certification project that would encourage and eventually require our members of the Guardian Conservator Association to participate in certification and education and continuing education so that we would have a common platform from which to do the work that we want to do. Now, we understand that with House Bill 3129, there is some talk about making this mandatory and statewide, and we would like to go on record as saying we support that, but we would like you to know what we've already done. So with that, I will thank you very much for listening.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, Michael O'Shea with Tiffany and O'Shea. We're a private fiduciary firm in Oregon, based in Happy Valley. I have 10 employees from varied backgrounds, like Nancy was talking about. I have an attorney, an RN, social workers, computer programmer. We have about 170 clients appointed by the court to manage their world. And as you've heard earlier, that means everything that there is to do for a human being, from their health care to real estate to putting people in jail who have abused them. We do it all. And I'm a strong advocate for the GCA, the Guardian Conservator Association, and the certification that takes place through the Centers for Guardian Certification. And would strongly advocate that the state make that a mandatory for all professional fiduciaries. It's a good practice to work with the GCA for me. It's brought me a great bit of support and education, and I would strongly urge you to support the amended bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I will have Nancy McDonald and Kevin Burke. State your name.
Good afternoon. I'm Nancy McDonald, and I believe or hope that you have my written testimony before you, which I worked hard to make brief and concise,
Thank you.
I'll pare it down now to 10 seconds.
Okay.
Because everything that was said is reflected in my opinion. If there's one thing that hasn't been pointed out yet very clearly, it is that the certification that does exist nationally will have no cost effect on the state of Oregon. The fees are presently paid by the fiduciary and will continue to be paid by the fiduciary, so there's really no cost involvement in putting in place this mandatory effort. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I am Kevin Burke. I'm also a professional fiduciary. I've submitted some written testimony. I just handed in, so it's probably not up there yet. And I will continue to be brief and just say that I was the president of the GCA the year we put in the voluntary certification plan. I'm also a certified professional guardian in Washington because my firm has an office in Vancouver, so I've seen how that works. At the time that we put it in Oregon, that we embraced it essentially as an organization, we were always had in the back of our mind that this might be something we could offer to the legislature at some point. I'm going to say this is that point. I'll simply point out that Illinois and Alaska are states similar to Oregon in having a relatively small number of professional fiduciaries and a really large need for certification. They have followed this path and made national certification through the Center for Guardianship Certification mandatory in their statutes. And it's something I encourage you to think about in your process. The rest of my testimony is simply some reflection on the core values of guardianship and how those are supported, the issues of making that the fact that if you're a certified professional guardian, substitute judgment respecting the values of the protected person, ensuring a sort of a due process after appointment, that you're always considering what they want and need, is a core value of the Center for Guardianship Certification, as is placing a person in the least restrictive setting, meaning if a person has a traumatic brain injury and gets better, it is your responsibility to move them into an apartment, say, from a group home, even if it's going to make your life a bit uncomfortable for a while. That's something that you commit to as a professional when you accept this certification. Thank you.
Any quick questions? Thank you so much for coming to testify today. All of you came to testify. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
We don't have the fiscal on this, right? Mm-hmm. So we're expecting that it'll be fairly small, so I'm hoping that this is a bill that we'll be able to pass, and we'll ask for a work session soon so that we can get the fiscal and hopefully begin to pass this. So we really appreciate all the work you've done on this, and we're hoping that we can work together with you to make this reality. Representative Gilliam, did you have something? You look like you're about to speak.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you. Okay. There is one more thing. I'm going to be closing the public hearing on House Bill 3129.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I may, I'd like to move we suspend the rules and invite Representative Kenny Geyer to vote on 2477, 2417, with the work sessions we had at the beginning of the session today.
Yes. Any objection? Then I will open up the work session on House Bill 2477. Representative Kenny Geyer, how do you vote?
Aye.
Thank you. I will close the work session on House Bill 2477. Open up the work session, House Bill 2417. And Representative Kenny Geyer, how do you vote?
I vote aye.
We will close the work session, House Bill 2417. I will close the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And thank you all. Thank you.
You're absolutely right.